Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode in Season 2 of the CoverCast podcast. This podcast is an initiative of the Cover Project and co-hosted by myself, Penina Achayo-Laker, and my friend and colleague, John Inazu. John and I are both faculty at Washington University in St. Louis and fellows with the Cover Project. Our hope with this podcast is to engage with Christian faculty in higher education through highlighting their scholarship, research, teaching, and service to bridge those connections between university, church, and society. Today, we're extremely honored and excited to spend some time talking with Rich Mao. Rich, welcome to the CoverCast podcast.
Hey, great to be with you, both of you. Thank you.
Richard, it's so great to have you with us. Rich spent a bunch of his time teaching at Calvin College, and Penny and I both have colleagues here who are Calvin alums, and I love seeing what the kind of people that Calvin produces for higher ed today. It's exciting to see. And then Rich was also the president of Fuller Seminary for a while. And I wasn't going to say this, but I'm going to say it. Rich, you're one of my heroes. I mean, you really, you're someone I admire for so many reasons, both in terms of the substance of your scholarship, your mode of academic engagement, what you do for institution building. And I just feel very privileged to be able to talk with you in this context, to introduce you to a broader audience as we think about these questions. So thanks for being here and thanks for making time with us.
Well, thanks for your kind words. I must say that I reciprocate on that. I'm just so impressed, and I've learned a lot from you, John, and great to be with both of you.
Well, this is going to be great. I wonder if we could start maybe by just, we often ask our guests, what got you into the academic life in the first place? Where, you know, what was it that as you were kind of feeling out what your place in the world was, what led you to the academy, and what kinds of sort of insights and advice did you feel along the way to that journey?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's a fairly clear sense of sort of when it happened for me. The background is that I'm a preacher's son, a pastor's son, and My parents both came from a very, I would say, evangelical, anti-intellectual background. And it was just taken for granted by my parents and by the extended family that I would be a pastor like my dad. And I internalized that. I assumed that as well. And but I was at Houghton College in Western New York, you know, Christian Liberal Arts College. I was an English major, and I really enjoyed studying literature. But I also took some philosophy courses, and I really liked studying philosophy. And I had a professor who was very dynamic and really was good at getting ordinary students excited about philosophical questions, you know, David Hume and Immanuel Kant, Aristotle, Plato, all of that. And I got very excited about that. And one day, after an especially inspiring, stimulating class, it occurred to me, I could do this. It was like a moment of revelation, you know, I could do this. I don't have to be a pastor. In fact, in my deepest places, I don't really want to be. And that set me on the path. And I went on to seminary, actually dropped out. I think I was the only president of a seminary in North America who actually was a seminary dropout. And never got ordained. But I took 2 years in seminary in Holland, Michigan, and took courses across the street at Hope College, trying to build up almost the equivalent of a philosophy major, because I'd been an English major, with the intention of going to grad school. And I had a professor there who helped me. I wanted to go to a small program to get started, so I went to the University of Alberta. My professor at Hope had a colleague there in philosophy. They'd gone to grad school together. I got a little fellowship to go there and immediately started teaching philosophy at the University of Alberta. And then went on from there to, after a master's degree, to get a PhD at the University of Chicago. And right around that time, the University of Illinois at Chicago Circle, now it's just University of Illinois Chicago, had gotten started in a brand new campus down near the Loop. And I got a job part-time teaching there while I was working on my PhD at Chicago. And so I had a wonderful time teaching university level introduction to philosophy courses, history of philosophy courses. And that's really how I got into it. And then Alvin Plantinga, who was at Calvin College at the time, and but as you may know, one of the great philosophers in the American tradition.
Right.
He was a visiting professor at the University of Chicago, and I took his graduate seminar, and we chatted a little bit, not much, but you know, I had a Dutch name, and he did a little bit. And the last day of class, he said, "Mal, let's go for coffee after class." And we got in the elevator at Swift Hall at the University of Chicago, and he turned to me and he said, "Now, are you a Calvinist?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Then I think you ought to teach at Calvin College." to make a long story short, I ended up being appointed to Calvin College for 17 years. And those were wonderful years. I taught with Nick Walmersdorf and Alvin Plantinga and a number of others in a really fine philosophy department. Where I think I learned as much as I taught. Some wonderful students, really good philosophy majors. It was, and then there were people like George Marsden were there, and Paul Henry, who was Carl Henry's son, went on to become a congressman. He was elected to Gerald Ford's seat and served in that for 8 years in Congress, and then had a brain tumor and tragically, went on to be with the Lord, but those were wonderful years in my life. And, yeah.
Wow.
Unfolded.
it's amazing just to hear how your journey has woven through multiple paths, and it sounds like you've met some really great people who've inspired you along the way. But I want to take you back to your early days in college, and I'm curious if there were any moments of tension between yourself and your parents, seeing that you mentioned they were anti-intellectual or maybe expected you to just go one specific route, but you were in college enjoying philosophy and all that. What was that like?
Were there any moments of tension?
Yeah.
Well, it'd be better to ask whether there were any really moments, at least when it came to my vocational plans. No, it was really hard my dad had gone through an undergraduate program and gone to seminary, but he was working the whole time. And I really can't say he learned a lot. He went to a more liberal seminary and really did not, wasn't very open to what he was being taught. So it was pretty tense with them and the extended family. I remember from a dear friend of the family, I got a letter. I just started writing about this recently again, where he told me how deeply disappointed my parents. He said, "They may not want to tell you this, but you know they really worry about you because you're going to go off and study."
Uh-huh.
And then he said, "Foolosophy, you know, F-O-O-L, foolosophy." And so that was pretty much the tone of it in my kinship system.
Hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, that's reflective of, I think, a lot of the tensions that we feel in higher ed today, trying to be faculty in these places that a lot of the church wants to write off as full of philosophy, right?
Yeah, and I want to say, I think, and you know, for the sake of many of my fellow my colleagues in the Academy who might be listening to this, many of us represent a generation that really had to fight our way into the Academy. We weren't blessed by those who had nurtured us in the faith. And we entered into the Academy where there was often a lot of hostility when people found out what we believed. I'll never forget, there was a crazy, very well-known philosopher at Alberta when I arrived, and he was from Norway. And he said to me, "Now, there's something strange about you. I forget what it was, but I remember we discussed it. Did you study," and he said this sneeringly, "theology?" Yes. He said, "I mean, like, do you believe all of that?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I believe what I was taught." And then he said, "Oh, that's interesting, because you look so sane." He said, "I did."
Wow.
A person once who told me that he believed, but he foamed at the mouth. Yeah.
Huh.
And that was my first day in grad school. And, so I want to say that there is a whole generation of Christian intellectuals in the Academy who had to fight our way to find our place. And I think things are much easier these days.
Yeah, interesting. I think you're right. And I just want to affirm that, you know, the tensions are not as great as you might, you know, experience them on Fox News or something like that. But they are still there. I mean, I remember when I was a practicing lawyer and I called my parents and said, "Hey, I'm going to go do a PhD in political theory." And my dad said, "You're going to what?" So there is, I think, still a sense of what are you doing, you know, in this teaching thing. And then in the other direction, you know, your story was so interesting because I've actually had a couple of those experiences as well. Not many, but when they come up, you realize, oh, under the hood with some of our colleagues is the sense like that we're just kind of crazy people for believing this. And I find rooting those kinds of exchanges in a deeper friendship that can emerge, you know, when you're living life together as teachers and on a faculty, I can absorb it. I don't feel like anyone is out to get me or that I'm, you know, facing massive oppression or anything like that. But it is a little, it can be jolting to realize, oh, this person actually does not think that it's intellectually possible to believe in Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Mm. You know, it's interesting. I was invited once to, many times, but Ivy University invited me to speak on a campus and give a public lecture on, you know, faith and the life of the mind or something. And I was contacted by the philosophy department. They said, "Since you're going to be on campus, would you be willing to give a paper and maybe talk about how does a person of evangelical faith approach issues of social political philosophy," which was one of my areas. And I agreed to do it, and they set up two respondents, and one was a secular person of Jewish background who typically did not like anything that I said in my paper. But the other was a political scientist who'd been on that faculty for 25 years, and they said, you know, he probably will be quite critical of you too. But when he responded, it was an amazing moment. He said, I want to say very publicly and openly that I agree with Mao. I agree with what he says in this paper about the role of faith in understanding social political life. And he said, I have taught at this university for 25 years, and this is the first time that I've ever said this publicly. I'm a Christian. I'm a Catholic.
Wow.
I'm a devout practicing Catholic, but I have never seen that as having an impact on the way I do scholarship. He said, but last year at the American Political Science Convention, I saw a notice about a group of Christians who were going to talk about being Christians in political science. And he said, I went out of curiosity. And he said, there were a lot of evangelicals, but also some Catholics. And he said, for the first time, I began to wrestle with this. And this is a whole new thing in my life. And I just want to say I'm so grateful that I have the opportunity to go public on this today.
Wow.
And I think that, for the two of you, I think that for Christians out there in the broader academy, there are two resources that are very important. One is the network of Christian colleges and universities of the evangelical brand, the CCCU, and also these field-specific groups, Christians in social work, Christians in political science, the Society of Christian Philosophers. I'm on the board of BioLogos, which nurtures people in the sciences, founded by Francis Collins. And in many ways, these are the Christian colleges and these groups of vocationally specific foci are something like, I think, monastic orders. That is, in the traditional Benedictine community, for example, they see themselves as submitting to disciplines on behalf of the whole Christian community.
Hmm.
And there's something about the ways in which I think Christians at evangelical schools and Christians who sustain these vocation-specific groups can be helping to preserve a sense of support and identity and fidelity for people who are out there beyond the bounds of the Christian community. And I think that's very, very significant.
Well, I think, it's really one of the intuitions we have here at the Carver Project of just being a visibly expressive community of Christian faculty together. And, it's helpful to us. It's helpful to students and prospective students. And, we don't have any illusions that we're going to take over WashU or anything. We're just happy to be here. And we're excited to be part of this WashU community. And we're excited to do it as Christians. And, when we can find common ground, great. And other times we won't, but we are committed. I loved the way you put it there. We're maybe a sort of a monastic outpost that is committed to really good at the craft and the skills in the guild that we've been called to.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too to see how just having that sense of community and support and an identity in our faith. I think I've experienced lately that a few students I've engaged with somewhere, somehow, without even me saying Jesus or Christ or God in that classroom, will reach out to seek some kind of counsel based on their work or scholarship, and then we'll go on to just mention how they are also a person of faith. And in fact, yesterday I had a student tell me, I'm a person of faith, and I just want to have a sense of peace in my choices and vocation. And I don't know, I think some of that has to do with, seeing that the Carver Project has provided a community, mentors, and I feel a sense of confidence in my faith, but also in who I am. And I think it's not something to take for granted. And I'm so grateful for people like you who've gone before us. And I've had a much harder and hostile experience. And I've laid a foundation so that we can have it a little bit easier along the way.
That's great. Yeah.
Rich, one of the things that we talk about at the Carver Project is how Christian faculty are kind of dual translators. We're trying to translate into the university all of this Christian stuff and what it means in our lives and in our sense of purpose and why we're here. But we're also trying to translate back in the other direction the really powerful and helpful insights from our disciplines and from the university that could benefit the church. And I mean, you as well as maybe anyone I know, knows some of the challenges of the translation in that direction, some of the suspicion, hostility, and dismissiveness that the church and Christian communities can put up against these sort of insights, whether it's labeling them as ungodly secularism or some form of critical theory or whatever it is to just discount it, when in fact the church has flourished best when it encounters new ideas and borrows well from them, takes what is good and discerns what is bad. And I'm particularly struck as we're talking to you in the current few years where questions about race and racial justice, especially, and some of the impulses generated by higher ed and the university and elsewhere are not always being well received by the church, and especially the white evangelical church. And I know that you have had a long, long history on this question and these issues in particular. And I wonder, so for the benefit of our listeners, but also just for us, if you might kind of share some of your views and some of your experiences over the years on this question.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. You know, one of the best sermons, one of the most memorable sermons I ever heard was by a pastor in Grand Rapids who preached on Jonah in the hold of the ship. And he said, you know, just look at, take a snapshot of what's going on there. There's this storm. There's a prophet of God in the ship. And there are also these pagan sailors. And the pagan sailors get into an argument with the prophet of God. And he said, from everything that we believe and know, we put our money on the prophet of God. But in this case, the sailors were right and the prophet of God was wrong. You know, because they were seeing that he was running away from something. And then the point of the sermon was, sometimes the world preaches good sermons to the church. You know? And to me, that is so relevant to our present situation, you know, that it isn't just trying to find common ground with radical secular feminism critical race theory, or the sort of lit crit deconstructionism in English departments, but it's actually trying to find out what they're telling us that maybe God wants us to understand. Yeah. Mm. And I think just to have that confidence that that there are times that the world, the unbelieving world, says to us, you're wrong about this. Huh. And they think you're right. And we need to hear that in a spirit of humility and with a desire to repent where we find out that we're wrong. And I think we're going through a period like that. Yeah. I think that some of the examples, John, that you gave are examples of where we really need to learn. And there was a wonderful liberation theologian from Argentina who wrote John Stott invited him to come to London to give lectures on liberation theology to evangelicals. His name is Jose Miguez Benino. And he wrote his lecture became a book on Christians and Marxists in dialogue. And in there, he says, it's a memorable line for me. He says, Karl Marx is not our judge. God alone is our judge, but we have to allow Karl Marx to take the witness stand to testify against us. You know, to me, we're surrounded in university settings by people who we ought to invite to take the witness stand and to testify against us. And the inability to grasp that on the part of so many in our evangelical community, I think, is really a resistance to hearing God's concerns about many of our views and practices.
Yeah. I stumbled upon a video of you talking with, I think it was Laura Schmidt or some, I think it was Laura Schmidt on civility and arguing theology. And I thought what you said about every Christian being called to work towards peace and justice in the world, just to be right on par with this moment that we find ourselves in, and how we should allow for the discomfort that comes with not necessarily having the answers or being right, but taking a stance of listening, understanding, and being okay with being uncomfortable with it.
Yeah,
Yeah, so that was really great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, as we all know, and you know, we've all studied for our doctoral prelims and comps, and we know the pain of just mastering a subject matter. But there's also that spiritual pain that sometimes enters into it, where we're trying to master ideas that we're not comfortable with, but we really need to wrestle with. And to me, that's such an important part of it all.
Right. And there's a risk that comes with that too, right? Open inquiry necessarily requires a kind of risk that you could be unsettled in one of your prior beliefs. And that's hard. It makes me think of Leslie Newbegin and the idea that we are pursuing knowledge and faith with confidence, not a kind of epistemic certainty, and the importance of recognizing that difference.
Yeah, I'm sure both of you know who Simone Weil was, W-E-I-L. Mm-hmm. She once, in one of her little books, she says, I'm really learning what it means to follow the truth wherever it goes. She said, because as a believer, I know that I cannot move too far in the direction of the truth without falling into the arms of Jesus, who is the truth.
Mm.
And to me, that's a motivating thing in my own life. You know, if I really want to know the truth about race, I really want to know the truth about cross-cultural concerns or intercultural concerns, or about gender issues, or about the sexual orientation issues. I really need to be willing to wrestle and step out in a spirit of wanting to learn, knowing that Jesus is out there waiting to welcome me into some kind of understanding of things.
Mm. Yeah, that's the kind of posture that can get stifled if we react in fear first, right? Which can drive things.
So it's vulnerability, but not hostility, and not even a kind of disorienting fear. But there has to be trust.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. And at the same time, it's not soupy relativism. It's not.
No.
Right. And it takes time to build trust as well. Takes time,
yeah.
To do that. Wow, there's definitely so much, and I'm looking at the time and I'm just wondering how is it that we're almost at 30 minutes here. But I would love to hear a little bit more about your teaching and your experiences in the classroom. Do you have a favorite class or a particular learning environment that just makes you feel joyful and happy and energetic?
Yeah, well, two things emerge. One, when I arrived at Calvin College, 1968, I began the fall of 68, and I had been involved in the radical student stuff in the 60s on university campuses. I marched against the war in Vietnam. I participated in civil rights protests and the like. And felt very lonely as an evangelical Christian. Those were lonely days. And it was only in about 1970 that a group of us discovered each other, you know, Ron Sider and Jim Wallace and Lucille Sider-Dayton and a number of others who discovered that we'd all been through those lonely days on secular campuses where there weren't many evangelicals who supported the kinds of things that we were working for. So I arrived at Calvin College in 68, and they had a course on the books called Social Political Philosophy that had never been taught. And I decided to teach it. And, you know, a good-sized class at Calvin was 30 or 40 students. I got 100 students in my first class.
Wow.
Just eager to think about social political issues in a philosophical sense, but also as they illuminated many of the practical concerns that we had. And I'm not sure it was, I thought all that great, of course, but I also realized how little there was by way of resources for evangelical Christians in this area. There just wasn't a lot of literature. So we had to learn from mainline Protestants and from Catholic social theory, try to integrate that with ideas that you find in Hobbes and Locke, Rousseau, Aristotle. It was kind of a fun time. And that became my my main course at Calvin. I mean, I taught ethics, I taught introduction, I taught history. But that social political philosophy over my 17 years was it was a popular course, not because I was popular, but because students were eager to wrestle with these issues. Mm-hmm. Then I arrived at Fuller Seminary in 85 to teach social ethics. But not long after that, I became provost and then I became president. So I had to decide I couldn't teach a full load, but I wanted to keep teaching. And I focused in on a course on Christ and culture. The H. Richard Niebuhr book kind of set the agenda for a lot of that, but it had to be updated in a lot of ways. I got into dialogue with people from the Anabaptist tradition, people from the Catholic tradition. I gradually also reached out beyond the Christian community, doing stuff with Jewish political thought, First Amendment issues and the like. And there too, I had large classes that of students who were going into youth ministry and like, and you know, to think about culture. Today, the culture of gaming, huge issue. And very little critical thinking about what is virtual space. How do we enter into that? More people did esports on Super Bowl Sunday than watch the Super Bowl, And it's an international subculture. I mean, you're often playing with, you're living in Lincoln, Nebraska, but you're playing with people in Singapore and Brussels. And a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that there's this whole new international subculture that is emerging of people who feel partnership, who feel a kind of shared set of interests with people of their own age around the world. And, we need to be thinking, taking on the new issues all the time. So anyway, I get excited.
I love that. I've got a follow-up to take us home and close us out today. But before I do, I can't let it go without a comment. You said earlier in the podcast that the Calvin philosophy department, when you got there, was Walter Sorf, Plantinga, and Mao. And anyone who knows anything about philosophy, I mean, that's a pretty powerhouse faculty. That's incredible. I mean, I can't imagine, being a philosophy major at the time. That must have been stunning. Here's the question, though, Rich, to close this out, and it actually follows right from what you were just talking about in terms of all of the emerging cultural issues. And it's going to be a big question, and so I'm not expecting a complete answer, but I'm interested in the future of theological education in the West. And how are we training, equipping, and preparing the next generation of pastors, but also theologians, given the state of higher ed, the tremendous pressures on seminary education, and the growing need for expertise in exactly these areas, the culture of gaming, or the influence of algorithms on social media, or, in my area, the First Amendment, or in Penina's area, questions of human-centered design, all of these areas where you're just not going to have seminary professors with that expertise and have pressures on the institutions themselves. So if you were going to just give us, the 3-minute Rich Mao dream of how to reimagine theological education in the West, what would it be?
That is a big issue. Let me say, first of all, that during my career, during the years in which I've been involved in the Evangelical Academy, much of the inspiring and guiding stuff of the issues that you're talking about, John, has actually come from outside of the theological community. It's people like Arthur Holmes at Wheaton, it's Nick Waldersdorf, it's George Marsden, it's sociologists like James Hunter and Davison Hunter and folks like that. There's really been very little from seminaries, mainly because seminaries have been very sort of churchy centered, and they see themselves as training people for pastorate. And I think things have begun to change in good ways because of this wonderful area that evangelicals, for all of our faults, have been very good at, and that is youth ministry. Joel Carpenter wrote a book on the history of evangelicalism after World War II, and he talked about Youth for Christ and Young Life and InterVarsity and other groups like that. And he said, you know, the liberal establishment often saw evangelicals as kind of anti-culture and not very interested in culture, because they meant by culture, you know, opera and film and literature and the like. And some of that was quite justified. But the one thing evangelicals, the fundamentalist movement after World War II, has been very good at is understanding youth culture. And the fact that we still have young people who get excited about Jesus in ways that you're not seeing very much in the mainline churches these days. They're losing a whole generation, and we may be losing a lot of it, but we're still holding on to young people who like to praise Jesus, who like are very concerned. But there are also people who are really interested in gaming, thinking in Christian ways about that. My students that I see coming into Fuller are very concerned about the environment. They're very concerned about race. They may be conservative on orientation issues, but they dated somebody in high school who came out a couple years later, or they've got a cousin who came out as a lesbian, you know, and they love those people, and they're not angry, hostile. They want how can we reach people who are different from us in gentle and kind ways. And now here we're seeing, the virtualization of theological education right now. There are very few seminaries where anybody's sitting in classes. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, it's reaching more people. And it's I think in some ways, the fact that we're doing something new may very well also make us open to some new areas of cultural engagement in the ways in which we frame our curriculum and the like. So I'm hopeful. At the same time, I feel a bit of a failure as somebody who spent 35 years in a theological seminary and really did not see the kinds of changes that I hoped for when I first join the Fuller faculty. And that's not a criticism of Fuller in particular, it's a criticism of theological education in general. But I do think pastors are these days, right now, thinking about what does it mean to be a pastor? I mean, I used to stand in the pulpit and people would sing hymns. And right now, we can't do a lot of that. I mean, COVID-19 has transformed in many ways maybe temporarily, but it's transformed the worshiping life of the church. And it may be putting new things on our agenda that we need to wrestle with.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and whether the church will be able to respond to the contingencies of history with hopefulness and imagination, right? That seems to be always the question, and that's still the question for this generation now.
Absolutely. Yes.
Well, Rich, this has been delightful. I'm so glad that we found the time. Thank you for sharing with us. It's always great to talk to you and appreciate your being with us here.
Well, I'd like to ask the two of you the same set of questions, so maybe I should sort of...
our podcast.
It's an honor for me to be with you. Thank you. Blessings on what you're doing, and to people out there who are listening to this. We're in it together, and these are, I think, exciting days of new challenges and opportunities.
Indeed.
Amen. What a great ending there. Thanks.
Thank you.